Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next edition of Mindful Meets. And today I am delighted to welcome Nina Sheldon, who is the founder of Make Light Matter. And we're going to be talking about nutrition, but not the nutrition in the normal sense that you might hear from me in terms of stuff that you put in your mouth. Food and drink. We're going to be talking about a different kind of nutrition, and that is light nutrition. I'm going to let Nina talk more about that, but let me just tell you a little bit about what her organization is, what it stands for. So it's a social enterprise on a mission to, as it says on the tin, make light matter. And it's about empowering individuals to really live life to the full. She really aims to educate and connect individuals and organizations and professionals around this whole topic of light nutrition, and we'll hear all about it in a minute, supporting them to take positive behavioral and environmental steps to increase well-being. And it's a fascinating subject, and I chanced upon Nina by accident, and it's such a happy accident. Nina, I'm so pleased to welcome you to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Laurie. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, you are most, most welcome. So would you like to start by talking a little bit about yourself and how and why you started Make Light Matter?
Yeah, so in my early 20s, I was diagnosed with seasonal affective disorder, or SAD for short, SAD. And it was something that I feel quite lucky that I got such an early diagnosis, because some people reach their 60s and never realize that that was what they were dealing with every single year. And so from there, I've had a bit of a journey of learning how to manage this condition, how to live with it, because it's not something that you can treat. It's something that you have to very much manage on a year-to-year basis. And my particular variety of SAD is actually bipolar disorder with a seasonal pattern. So we're going to get into more of that in a minute. But yeah, in terms of learning how to manage it for myself, you know, the doctor is very lucky that he had heard of SAD and could connect the symptoms that I was describing with that condition. And I got a diagnosis, which was a great comfort to me. Some people don't like labels, but actually it was a great comfort to me personally, because I finally had an explanation for what was going on, why I felt the way I did. And from there, I was, you know, learning how to manage the condition myself, I finally got some semblance of feeling like it was under control. So I started to try and support other people once I was managing my own condition. Through a forum. And through that forum, what we found was that people were all on the forum to get help and not necessarily there to provide support, because they maybe didn't have their condition as well managed. And I thought, oh, there must be a blog post somewhere that people, you know, a blog out there about this, because there's blogs for everything, right? And so this was back in 2012, and I couldn't find something. So I set one up of my own called Little Lightroom. And this has all been a bit of an evolution on the journey. And so I started this blog. I later started some events in 2016. And that was in response to people saying, well, I would try light therapy, but it's really expensive. So these light boxes that you can get are a primary way of treating SAD. And they were saying, oh, well, I don't really, you know, want to put that investment in without knowing what it's like to sit in front of one. So start some events. You got this dual treatment, if you like, of company, mindfulness, because we did some crafting, and then the light therapy. So I ran that for 3 years in Newcastle on a monthly basis. And then I got made redundant from a job, and I decided to go freelance with copywriting again. I've done it several times along the way. And that just gave me a little bit of time. I decided to do that part-time so that I could then focus a little bit more on what I called this light stuff at the time. and then because of that, we formed as Lightopia Kick. So it's a community interest company, as you say, a social enterprise. And really, we incorporated in 2018, but then I've been spending all that time since engaging with people out in the industry to explore this ecosystem. And it really is a massive ecosystem, because when you consider, you know, all the different elements, we can get into that. But that's what I've been doing. I've been researching, I've been speaking to people, and I've realized that it's much bigger than SAD. And that there's actually other conditions that, you know, are affected by light and our circadian rhythm, how light impacts on our body. And yeah, so, you know, like Make Light Matter was a recent rebrand of Lightopia Kick. We're still Lightopia Kick, but we are trading as Make Light Matter. And it's really, like you say, it does what it says on the tin name. The biggest problem that we have is that we don't understand how light impacts on our well-being. And that's something that we aim to change.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. I love the way it's just become an organic thing. And I suppose I can relate to that because my business, the Michael Easton Clinic, was all totally organic and almost by accident, which came out of me treating my own disordered eating, and then it sort of grew. And don't you think that if our business is driven by our own personal connection and our personal experience, we just have a connection with it which is different, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think with seasonal affective disorder, what I hear from people quite often, and I've experienced myself, is that we feel like we're living a half life. You know, if you consider that maybe 5 to 6 months of the year you don't feel quite yourself. You know, and that's a long time. Every single year it can feel like a life sentence, and that's something that I really want to try and help change for people.
Absolutely. And I wonder actually how many people listening now feel a little bit off during those dark months and don't really know why. They just think that that's how they have to live and don't really understand either about SAD or any of the other conditions that they might have. And then equally what they can do about it. So I think it'd be really helpful, Nina, with all your knowledge and experience, if you could talk a little bit about SAD and potential other factors that people might be experiencing to actually help them understand it and feel less isolated, perhaps.
Yeah, of course. So seasonal affective disorder, as I've mentioned, is it's of two kind of, it's either a variant of clinical depression, or it's a variant of bipolar disorder. And it's those conditions, but they come and go in a seasonal pattern. That's what marks them out as being seasonal affective disorder. And you can actually get SAD at any time of the year. That's what a lot of people don't realize as well. It's rarer. So the most common forms you'll experience in winter, so as the autumn onset, after the clocks change usually, it's the shortening of the days that scientists believe is the main trigger. And the causes, I don't want to get into lots and lots of biology, but they think that the cause is the lack of light. So as the days get shorter, we tend to stay indoors a little bit more because of the weather and because it's darker days. And also maybe because we're working or studying and things like that. And we're just indoors, and indoor light is not enough to give our brains that signal that tells us, hey, it's morning. And so in particular, in the last 15 months or so with the pandemic, when many of us have been staying at home a lot more, domestic lighting in particular is much less intense than daylight, but also from offices as well. So you maybe 100 to 300 lux, which is a measure of light intensity, in an indoor domestic environment. And then in an office environment, you might have 300 to 500 lux. Whereas if you get yourself outdoors, on a spring clear morning, you're looking at getting 10,000 lux.
Oh, wow. So the difference is enormous. I had no idea that the difference was so, so, so marked.
Yeah. Obviously, on a cloudy day in the middle of winter, you might be getting more like 1,000 lux. And that can sometimes, for some sensitive individuals that experience the clinical level of seasonal affective disorder, that might still not be enough. So you might need to supplement your light with a light box. Yeah. And the light box, usually as an industry standard, would provide 10,000 lux. And you sit in front of it and it just gives you this dose of light therapy. And what that does for your body is it tells your body what time of day it is. So our bodies run on like a what we call a circadian rhythm, and it's around a day. And so when our body receives a light cue, it says, oh, okay, I know what time of day it is. It's time to get up because it's light, or it's getting dark, so it's time to go to sleep. And our brain coordinates all of the chemicals in our body. So light actually impacts every single cell in the human body, because every single cell has a clock gene. And every single cell, or nearly every single cell, has also a vitamin D receptor. So that's the other thing to bear in mind as well, is that a lot of people in this country, in the UK, or around the world at similar latitudes, in particular to the UK, will be vitamin D deficient.
Yeah, that's really interesting on two levels, because I know how important the circadian rhythm is in terms of regular eating. I mean, there's research that if you eat regularly and you listen to your body clock in terms of your nutrition, that actually you can prolong your life and you can reduce your risk of degenerative diseases. And it also helps you eat less, so to manage your weight, which is obviously something that I deal with a lot. But also the other thing is that I've noticed that I would say probably 9 out of 10 of the nutritional assessments that I do, based on a fairly short diary, maybe a 7-day food diary, vitamin D deficiency is always present, you know, almost without fail. And so I always encourage people to look into supplements. Is that something that you talk about to people in terms of the vitamin D?
Yeah, I'm not an expert and I'm not a doctor, so I can't sort of recommend that people specifically take a certain dose of vitamin D, but it is important that our individual levels reach at least what we call 25 nmol. I can't actually remember what it's called. I just know how it's written. So it's NMOL, but it's basically like the amount of vitamin D in a volume of your blood.
And different from the RDI then, for example, the recommended
the recommended daily intake is how much they think that most people should take to avoid becoming deficient. But at the same time, if you're already deficient, this is something I speak to people quite a lot about, is if you are already severely deficient in vitamin D and then you just take the RDI, you're not going to bring your levels up to the level that you need them to be. You'll just continue to be just a little bit less deficient, if that makes sense. So,
and in fact, in that case, somebody needs to talk to somebody like a nutritionist who can do a bespoke personal assessment of it.
Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, they can also go to their doctor. So if they are showing signs of vitamin D deficiency, so they call them Mohn's groans. What is it? Mohn's groans, bones, something like that. But basically, you know, you end up with very tired, very achy, it affects your mood and that sort of thing. And actually, a lot of the symptoms of vitamin D deficiency overlap with seasonal affective disorder. So actually, even if you do have seasonal affective disorder, you can deal with the vitamin D deficiency fairly easily by supplementing. It's quite hard to get enough vitamin D through your diet. So in the UK, in autumn and winter months, the UK government has recommended that everybody should take a supplement, and some people will need to take a supplement all year round. So people with dark skins, people who don't get out as much for whatever reason, maybe they're in nursing homes or in hospital, perhaps they have conditions that make their skin light sensitive, so they need to cover up, or maybe for religious reasons they cover their skin. So actually a lot of those people are at risk. And also pregnant women as well, who have additional needs for vitamin D because they're baby, and when they're breastfeeding as well. So those people are at particular risk of vitamin D deficiency, and it's actually quite an easy thing to deal with. So I would always say, you know, speak to your doctor, see if you can get a test. You can actually order private tests as well. You know, if your GP is not supportive of giving you a test, you can do one yourself at home.
Yeah,
that will give you a level, like a baseline level to work from.
And we should say, for those that aren't in the know about it, that the relationship with light and vitamin D is the fact that your body needs the sunlight to process the vitamin D and to use the vitamin D adequately. That's the relationship that we're talking about.
We make it skin as well, so like when something hits the skin, we make vitamin D, but during the autumn and winter months, the sunlight isn't intense enough for your skin to make vitamin D, and that's why we become deficient.
That's right, yes, we can manufacture this wonderful stuff ourselves, can't we, with the right light. Can you tell us a little bit more about what it feels like to have SAD, just to sort of describe it to people, and because they might be able to connect that with some of the symptoms that they feel, you know, and that, I think that might be helpful.
Yeah, so as I've said, that you have two main variants of the bipolar or the what we call it, like a classic depression or clinical depression. The other thing to say about seasonal affective disorder is that it's a scale. So you might experience milder symptoms, which would be known as winter blues or subsyndromal SAD, and that's what most people get. So you can imagine like a bell curve or a normal distribution curve. It kind of peaks in the middle. And most people will experience SAD to a certain degree in our UK population. And I think a lot of people are familiar with feeling just a bit tired, a bit down, a bit fed up in winter, maybe kind of craving carbohydrates a little bit. Those are very classical symptoms of SAD.
Feeling like they need a lift.
They need a lift,
of some sort, yeah.
Tired and down. And they might be a bit more grumpy and irritable and that sort of thing as well. And so at the kind of more manageable levels of those things, you would be said to experience winter blues or, as I say, subsyndrome or SAD. It's at the clinical end where it starts to really impact on your life and your ability to function day to day, that it becomes seasonal affective disorder. So it's at that further end of the scale where the symptoms are much more severe and they're impacting on your day-to-day life. And that's the same thing as what would we use with normal depression, if you like, or, you know, non-seasonal depression or non-seasonal bipolar, is that those incidents can happen at any time. It's the seasonal coming and going that makes it seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah.
Got to be sort of the same time each year. So I would say that, you know, with seasonal affective disorder, you'll know when it's kind of coming on, and it's really important to try and head it off at the pass. So the moment that you sort of start to notice that your mood's dipping, you may be feeling more tired, more grouchy. Irritability is quite often an early sign as well. So just inexplicably feeling like you just want to shout at everybody,
yeah.
You know.
Like your hormones are through the roof kind of thing.
Yeah. Much more, which wouldn't normally affect you. Tearfulness, just not enjoying activities that you would normally enjoy. So it is fair, as I say, it's fairly classical kind of depressive symptoms. But I'd say the main thing that marks out seasonal affective disorder as being a bit different is, as I say, it's the seasonal coming and going. So those symptoms resolve at the same time each year, and they start at the same time each year. And it's in a predictable pattern. So you'd need to have that for 2 years at least before you would be diagnosed with SAD. And then also you tend to eat more and sleep more. So whereas more classical depression, you might tend to lose your appetite and you might tend to have more disturbed and less sleep. With seasonal affective disorder, you can't get enough sleep and you can't get enough carbs. You know, it's a particular problem for people with seasonal affective disorder is controlling those carb cravings and the weight gain that we end up getting as a result of that. So very, you know, very sort of, you know, tied in with what you're looking at. And light therapy is the way that we kind of would look at that. The other thing with the bipolar variant is that in the spring months in particular, you will possibly experience something that we call hypomania. So the way, and this is what variant I experienced, so I have the bipolar variant, and I actually used to think that everybody got this, that had SAD. So I didn't realize until quite recently, actually, that I have the bipolar variant. I just thought that this was everybody's experience. And so I describe this, my favorite way of describing it is being like Tigger and Eeyore. So, you know, the familiar characters from Winnie the Pooh books. And in the spring months, you can suddenly feel as if you had too much caffeine. It's probably about the best way I can describe the experience of it, is you kind of have too much energy to a point of feeling quite uncomfortable. Sometimes you can't settle, you can't focus. Your speech is pressured sometimes. So, you know, maybe you've been a bit of a chatterbox, a bit too much so. Maybe you're kind of diving in and interrupting people all the time. You may be being quite short with people.
Some of those hyperactivity symptoms.
Yes, very much so. It's very much a hyperactivity. So again, I think that maybe some people will be looked at for ADHD perhaps, you know. And certainly there do seem to be linkages or certain crossovers with these things. So yeah, those are the kind of symptoms to watch out for, is if you reliably experience this kind of hyperactivity in the spring, followed by depression symptoms in the autumn and winter, I would definitely speak to a doctor about it. I mean, obviously, you know, some people will self-diagnose. However, as I say, because symptoms overlap, I would avoid doing that. I would try and go to your doctor, note down your symptoms, similar to what you ask people to do, Laurie, in a diary about their food. It's also worth just noting, you know, if you can, in a little diary, when some symptoms start, when they tend to resolve, whether you notice anything like you feel worse on days that are darker, for example, very grey days and that sort of thing, and what kind of symptoms you experience as well. So I think those are the first steps.
Oh, that is incredibly helpful. Thank you. And of course, I need to pick up on the point that you made around the carb craving and around the weight gain, because I think, you know, I deal with a lot of people who feel uncomfortable and there's a lot of self-blame around their eating behaviors, and they think it's because they can't control themselves and they're rubbish and they've got no discipline. Whereas in fact, it could be that during those winter months, there is something else going on over which they have no control because they don't quite understand it. So they blame themselves first, and that's quite common in a dieting history anyway, rather than perhaps standing back and looking more broadly at the symptoms that they have and asking whether there is something else going on. And just that point, my goodness, apart from everything else that you've said, could actually be quite life-changing for people who are listening at the moment. But of course, the good news is that there are things that we can do to help. So you've talked about trying to get a proper diagnosis and really trying to be aware of what the symptoms are. If we are more at that lower non-clinical diagnosis level, just what, you know, what a layman like myself might just call winter blues, what can we do to try and alleviate that?
Making sure you get as much daily light as you can is really important. So natural light is always preferable. It's not always possible. You know, the lifestyles that we lead, we spend 90% of our time indoors. And, you know, it's partly a lifestyle issue, I believe. And so morning light is particularly important because, as I said earlier about the circadian rhythm, the body clock, the light gives us a cue as to what time of day it is and what our body should be doing. So you talked about eating in a sort of regular pattern. Eating does help our body to understand what time of day it is as well. But light is the main regulator of that body clock. And so being able to get up and go outside, even if it's just for your morning cup of coffee, just take your morning cup of coffee outside or go for a little walk, you know, 10, 15 minutes will do it.
Whatever the weather. Actually.
Whatever the weather, yeah, put a waterproof on, probably don't take an umbrella, actually put a waterproof on, that's the best way, because the umbrella, especially if it's a dark color, will stop light getting in as much. But yeah, you know, a waterproof, some wellies or some good walking shoes, as long as you're togged out, you know, well, then most of the time you'll find that you don't mind the weather so much. Manage your mindset about the weather as well. It's one of those things that seasonal affective disorder seems to have a biological component. It seems to be genetic, but also it does seem to have a thinking styles component. So, you know, rumination and worry. And, you know, if, for example, looking outside and saying, oh, it's horrible weather today, you know, I'm not going to go outside. And it's trying to sort of challenge some of those thinking and behaviors and sort of think instead, you might not ever fall in love with autumn and winter weather, but you can maybe be a little bit less extreme about your views about it. So it's something I've been working on a lot about that, you know, the sort of cognitive behavioral therapy sort of way of thinking. And there are workbooks you can buy as well. So there's a really great one led by Kelly Rohan, who is a specialist academic researcher in seasonal affective disorder. She's over at the University of Vermont. And they're doing a lot of research and they're having a lot of success with seasonal affective disorder treated by cognitive behavioral therapy. And they're finding it just as effective as light therapy. So it has become a first line treatment alongside light therapy. Yeah. The thing with light therapy is if you stop doing it, the symptoms return. So you have to do it every day. So if you're just on that subclinical level, so the winter blues level, just getting out into daylight as often as you can will probably resolve most of your symptoms. But as I say, more clinical end, you might want to consider light therapy and CBT.
CBT, yeah. I think you make an interesting point, because we can all sit there and find a reason not to go out, can't we? Actually.
Yeah.
And as part of my mindful eating work, I talk about mindfulness as a separate thing. And, you know, there is so much beauty actually to be found outside on any day, beauty and or interest, you know. So if you live in an urban environment, you might be saying to me, well, actually, there's not much that's beautiful on a miserable November day in an urban environment. Well, okay, but if you put your mindful hat on and your I'm going to notice everything hat, you walk around, you look at the buildings, you look at the features, you look at what's happening or not happening in gardens. There are so many ways of appreciating the seasons. Trees without leaves are just as interesting as trees with leaves, you know. And if you're in the autumn, you've got all those colours. There are always things that you can stop and take notice of. And so perhaps to employ a mindfulness element at the same time is a reason for going out, as well as the fact that we have to get this light connecting with our bodies.
Yeah, and if you can use it as an excuse to sort of, if you can exercise outdoors as well, that can be quite a nice way of fitting in, and you sort of get almost like a, you know, a double effect then, because, you know, we know that nature as well, if you can get into green space, you know, so if you can get into green space and do some exercise and get some light, yeah, you've got fresh air as well. And that all helps with your sleep as well. So that's the other thing, is we talked about SAD, we talked about vitamin D deficiency. The circadian rhythms also impact on sleep. So we know that sleep disorder is a problem for a lot of people. But then we also have what we call social jet lag as well. So that's the tendency that if your body clock runs more towards the late time, so you're like a night owl, we call that a chronotype. And you're an early bird, a night owl, or you're somewhere in between. Most people are somewhere in between. There's few people that are true early birds and true night owls. But if you are sort of towards that night owl way, what you might find is that when you have to get up for work early during the week, you will do it because you have to do it. But on the weekend, you'll kind of treat yourself to a lie-in, and you'll go to bed later because that's your natural rhythm and that's what you want to do. However, that can be messing around with your body clock. And so your body clock's going, I don't know what day it is. I don't know what time of day it is, because you're kind of going to sleep at different times and you're getting up at different times. And sometimes you give me some light and sometimes you don't. So particularly, you know, those days when you go to work, when we were commuting to work more often, some of us still are, you would get that dose of light if it was light at the time. You know, if you were starting work after it got dark, then you might find that's when SAD peaks in particular, because we're not getting enough daylight. And if you don't get out on a lunch break, that sort of thing.
So if you think about people in an office then in the winter, so they're going to work in the dark, they're coming home from work in the dark, even if they're walking, if they are really busy, and we know that office environments, business environments, let's say work environments, could be anywhere, inside a hospital, anywhere, are pressured, and sometimes finding the time to get out isn't easy, they could potentially be in the dark for 5 days.
Yeah, absolutely. That's not an unusual thing. Yeah. That's what happens to a lot of people. Yeah. And that's where you'll find SAD peaking as well.
Yeah.
If you're not near the window during the day, you know, if you're deep plan, what we call deep plan, so further away from the window in these big
office spaces, and you're in the middle. Yes.
Then you're not getting enough light in that space to be able to stimulate that circadian rhythm and help your body understand what time of the day it is. And therefore you'll be feeling tired and low in energy. Yes. Possibly, as I say, with other impacts on your mood as well.
Yes. When I was on that fascinating webinar with you and with various other professionals, we had lighting designers, we had architects, we had planners, we had interior designers, we had nutritionists. It was absolutely brilliant. Lots of ideas being shared. There was a lot of discussion about changes in the workplace and trying to improve well-being. And I think from some of the contributions that I make to well-being hubs and those kinds of things, you know, there is a organisations seem to be taking more responsibility around, you know, mental health, nutrition, physical health, exercise. What's happening in terms of trying to get this whole light nutrition topic at the forefront of planners and organisations and HR in terms of making that better for their staff?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I first started Make Light Matter, there wasn't really anything going on. There was nothing really around, and I was kind of scratching my head thinking, have I just missed something? But actually in the last year in particular, I'd say things have really ramped up, because what they've done is the lighting industry in particular have woken up, I guess, to the health impacts of light. And then the building industry. So we've got something called the WELL standards, and that's becoming more and more popular. It's come over from America, and it's the International WELL Building Institute in America, and that's now becoming the kind of gold standard, if you like, for how buildings should be designed to support their occupants' wellness. And 90, I think it's 90% of the building's costs are in the people. And so actually focusing on the fabric of a building or the energy savings and what have you is not as effective as looking after the people in the building who do the work that you want them to do. You need them to be productive in order to serve your customers and make more money. And so the IWBI is making a fantastic business case for that. And so there are lots more organizations starting to spring up. I'm working on Make Light Matter part-time. So for me, everything feels like it's going a bit too slow at the moment for my liking. Yeah. There are other fantastic organizations springing up. So Age of Light Innovations by Dr. Shelley James. She's been leading some campaigns. She's now moving into that kind of well-building space as well to help procurement people to understand more about lighting. And I'd say where we've also got the lighting police that are looking at, you know, sort of different examples of lighting and where it's used well and where it can be improved, particularly where it can be improved. So there's all sorts of different organisations starting to spring up, and I'd say a growing awareness. And really, I guess it's a really exciting time, because there's a particular cell in the eye, that's only been discovered in the early 2000s. And actually, in scientific terms, that's no time at all. But they actually got a Nobel Prize for this research as well, because it's absolutely transformed our understanding of how light impacts on our well-being. And obviously, it's what, 20 years since that discovery? Not even quite 20 years. So it's a really exciting topic area. And they're making new discoveries all the time in the scientific field. And then it's really about translating that down into, well, what do we do about that as individuals? And I'd say where I come about it is, I'm very interested in the lighting industry and how we support people's well-being with the lighting. But for me, it's bigger than that. And it's actually about, yes, you can change your indoor environment and you can maybe select lighting that supports your circadian rhythm better. So the lighting industry have started to develop something that's known as circadian lighting. It's given a few different names. Sometimes it's called human-centric lighting or tunable lighting. But really what it does is its aim is to help your body by tuning the light to different levels. So in the morning, there'll be more blue and it'll be more intense. In the evening, there'll be more red and it'll be dimmer. And that's to support those body's rhythms. So the lighting industry is one side of things. I also think that the architects have a lot to play as well in terms of how they design the buildings and whether they face the buildings to get the maximum natural light, how big they make the windows. And there's tensions between kind of the environmental aspects, you know, too much glass creates too much heat.
Yep.
And then you use more
planning. There must be endless planning constraints.
All of that, absolutely. But really, I think for me, I would say that the best thing that we can possibly be doing is encouraging people to change their behavior. So we talked earlier on about going out at lunch breaks and things like that. And I think as much as possible, employers have a part to play. So we talked about the ecosystem. You've got the individual. So the individual can take personal responsibility for their own behavior and their own environment as far as that's possible. But if you're in an environment, say like a workplace or school, college, hospital, you know, nursing home, wherever, then you quite often don't have control over that environment and you spend your, you know, probably a large proportion of your life there. What can you do about that? Well, that's where employers and service providers can be more aware. And then they can develop cultures that encourage people to go outside or use the space in a flexible way where they can go and sit in a window. You know, so sit in a chair by a window, for example, for a
little
bit. That's
the thing, isn't it? It's about developing a culture. It's like with all these changes. I mean, before this life, I worked a lot in the corporate world and people would come to me to be able to do their jobs better. But there were often constraints around culture. But hopefully with more scientific research, that will then drive the understanding because evidence drives change, doesn't it? So if there's evidence and then cultures can change. But of course, it's a slowish process. Yeah. So I guess that in terms of people doing something now to make sure that if they're entitled to a break, because we're not always that good at these things, you know, we're entitled to an hour's break. To close the laptop, to stop the work and say, it'll be there when I get back. I'm going to walk around the block for at least half of that time. And this ties in actually really well with some of the stuff that I encounter in that people say, I haven't got time for lunch. Of course you've got time for lunch. You have to make time to eat. So now we're going to say, you've got to make time to eat and you've got to make time to get outside. Perfect. That's how you make the most of that hour that you have. And don't let any culture around you compromise that because you have to come first. You know, you as the individual have got to put yourself first, haven't you?
Absolutely. And I think that's something that, you know, for myself, I've been looking at a lot more as well. I've worked in, you know, in marketing for my whole career and, you know, full-time hours in an office environment. Marketing is very deadline driven. So, you know, there's constant pressure. You know, we're not saving lives, but, you know, it is pressure in nevertheless. Yes. And I've often experienced exactly as you say, where it's been feeling like I can't take a break. You know, I've just got to eat my lunch at my desk, you know, and not take a break. And you just feel worse for it, I think. Like, I find that when people do take up the suggestions that I give them to get outdoors more often, maybe a morning walk before they start work, or going out on a lunch break, they quite often will find that they're much more effective and productive for the rest of the day. Yeah. So, you know, for me, again, employers can really help with the cultural aspect of this in terms of my employer. I work for 3 days a week for an organization. And they've been fantastic with me. They obviously know that I experience seasonal affective disorder. They know how important light is to me. And so I've arranged with them that during the autumn and winter months, when it's not light before I start work, I'll start work a little bit earlier. So I might start work at say 7:30 and I'll get a couple of hours work done. And then I'll take a break at 9:30 and I'll go out for a walk at 9:30. And then I'll go out for a walk again at lunch. And it only 15 minutes. I'm not talking an hour walk. Yeah. I mean, you can do an hour walk, amazing. But, you know, 15 minutes, it makes no real difference to my employer if I'm away for 15 minutes. But it makes all the difference to me and my effectiveness and my productivity as an employee.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, Nina, thank you. What a fascinating, fascinating talk. I think it's something that we should all really be aware of. And it's all part of this personal accountability for our health and our well-being, because the more of us that are talking about it, the more that culture around us and that acceptance and actually tolerance of putting ourselves first, because sometimes it is even down to that sort of level, isn't it, will actually increase. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you. So I will put in the details some information about, you talked about Kelly Rohan and Vermont, you talked about the Age of Light Innovations, you talked about the Lighting Police, and anything else that I think people are going to be interested in. But if they want to find out more about Make Light Matter or about SAD or the other disorders affected by light, where should they go?
They can visit the Make Light Matter website. So it's just makelightmatter.co.uk. And there's some blog posts on there. I'm going to be adding to those as we move forward.
Fantastic. And you're also on LinkedIn, aren't you? Which is where,
yes,
where I found you. Fantastic. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Really, really fascinating. And I think very beneficial to everyone listening. So I'm delighted that you joined me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me on.